met Michael Pollan about 7 years ago. I would say that the ability to move between the academic and the non-academic, to proceed through questions, and to display an infectious sense of curiosity are present through just about everything that Michael Pollan has authored. So is the ability to shift easily between the terms nature and environment, two sometimes extremely fixed categories, and to underscore the presence of weighty environmental problems in the various practices of everyday life, be this gardening, eating, or a chance encounter with a bee, a dog, and here in Berkeley, a raccoon. Unlike any of our previous lectures in a distinguished series funded by Joan and Peter Avenali, Michael Pollan is about to become a Berkeley professor. He's accepted an appointment, happily for us, beginning next fall. Before, however, he takes on his duties as a member of the School of Journalism, we at the Townsend Center wanted to welcome him also into the humanities and the various allied fields that the center serves. We hope that Michael will become and remain a regular presence among us, moving as easily among schools and disciplines as he did among the academics and non-academics. Because he's been on campus, many of you already know Michael Pollan. You know that he studied in Oxford and at Bennington College. You know that he took an MA in English at Columbia University. You know that he interned with the Village Voice. You know that he went on to work for 11 years as executive editor at Harper's Magazine, a time in which the magazine garnered 6 National Magazine Awards. You know he's been a contributing editor since 1995 to Harper's. You know that he contributes to the New York Times, at least any of you who read last Sunday's New York Times Magazine article on the unnatural idea of animal rights know very well. You know that his books are Second Nature, A Gardener's Education, A Place of My Own, The Education of an Amateur Builder, and most recently, The Botany of Desire, A Plant-Size View of the World. And the latter, of course, is on the New York Times bestseller list and is being translated into at least 6 different languages. Now, in case you thought I had forgotten, the title of tonight's talk is Cannabis, Forgetting, and the Botany of Desire. Please welcome Michael Pollan.
Thank you. That was great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate that warm introduction and welcome. I realize I always overdress when I come to Berkeley. I'm going to have to learn about that. It's great to be here, though. I want to get a couple things about myself out of the way before I start. One is, you know, I write about plants, and whenever I take questions from an audience, which I hope to do when I finish speaking, there's always someone who says, "Is that your real name?" I mean, it does seem awfully convenient, I realize that. But I've also learned from people asking these questions that it is a certain genre of name called the career natural. Or an even better term is the aptonym. And I have a good aptonym. And I've been collecting them. So if you have any good ones you can think of, please pass them down. Last time I was in the Bay Area, I was told about a podiatrist named Dr. Tozy, which I kind of liked. There are always doctors with these great names. I've collected a Dr. Slaughter, Smother, and Coffin. There are lots of great urologists. There's a Dr. Clapp in Buffalo and a Dr. Peckler somewhere else. And of course, the head of the Audubon Society is John Flicker. And at Friends of Animals, Priscilla Ferrell presides. But one of my favorites is a woman named Angela Overy, who wrote a wonderful gardening book called Sex in Your Garden. So we're going to talk a little bit about sex in your garden and drugs and rock and roll. And I want to start by briefly explaining what I mean by the botany of desire, about my approach to plants and their relationship to people. And then get on to marijuana. Those who've read the book, Botany of Desire, will recognize some of what I'm saying, at least at the start, but I then want to go a little bit deeper into what we've learned and what we're learning about cannabis and the cannabinoid network and memory. Since the book's come out, we're learning things actually almost every day about this. It's a very exciting area of brain science. Befitting this Avenali lecture and the setting, actually, I come at this scientific topic from very much a humanities point of view. I am told now I'm a science journalist, which came as something of a surprise to me. I didn't know I was writing science. I felt a little like the character in Molière who didn't know he was speaking prose. But apparently that is what I write. And I'm hoping from this particular setting in the periodic table to, you know, get a little more authority for my pronouncements, but don't be fooled. We have a bad habit in the humanities of assuming the scientists have the last word. But when I was doing the research for this, for my chapter on cannabis in the book, I remember asking a pharmacologist in New York who had studied drugs for years and years, and I said, well, what does it mean scientifically to be high? And he said something very interesting. He says, well, you know, we don't understand consciousness yet scientifically, so how can we hope to understand changes in consciousness scientifically? And he and others basically told me that, you know, you're better off with the poets for now on this one. This is one area where the philosophers and the poets may yet have much to teach the scientists. I also chose this topic for tonight, though, because here in California, we're in one of the most important theaters in the battle over marijuana, medical marijuana, I mean, which is the battle to re-legitimize this powerful plant. But I want to get past the drug war and the political perspective tonight. I'm not going to talk that much about it, although we could in questions if you like. I want to look at the plant and other plant drugs as Darwinians rather than drug warriors, if we can for a moment. And the last reason I chose this topic, because I think I'm in a room with people who are very well equipped, better than me, I think, to follow up some of the paths I'm hoping to just point out to you into the understanding of consciousness and drugs. But let me start with the plants. Their astounding and really overlooked power to nourish us and poison us, to delight our senses of sight and smell and taste, to calm our nerves or wake us up, even to change the contents of our minds and experience of consciousness. This, to me, is just an amazing fact, and it's an everyday fact that we don't really deal with, and that's really what I undertook to deal with in this book. The first question is, why should plants have these powers? And those of you who've read the book know that the beginning of my answer, or my attempt to find an answer, as so much of my writing began in my garden. I really began as a garden writer in many ways. And one of the things I love about gardening is it is very kind of desultory work. It doesn't occupy all of your brain by any means, at least the way I do it. And there's plenty of room for speculation and asking kind of silly questions. I've also written about carpentry. I wrote a book about architecture and building. And you do the same thing while you're learning carpentry, and you know, you end up like this. But in the garden, this isn't likely to happen. So I asked myself one day, it was the first week of May, I was planting potatoes, which you plant little chunks of potato, and right next to me was a flowering apple tree. And it was that week in May, the first week of May in Connecticut, where I live, in New England, where the apples are just in spectacular blossom, and the bees are going crazy, and this tree is just vibrating with the attention of these bumblebees. And I asked myself this sort of silly, but ultimately for me quite profound question, which is, what did I have in common with that bumblebee as workers in this garden? Now, I wasn't thinking about Marx, and many people on this campus have reminded me that Marx has a whole riff on bumblebees. This wasn't in my mind. So don't read that into what I'm saying. And I realized that actually the bumblebee and I had a lot in common. We both thought we were both going about getting what we wanted from nature, but at the same time we were unwittingly disseminating the genes of one species and not another. The bee, like me, to the extent he thinks about this, thinks he's calling the shots. Actually, it's she. In the case of bumblebees, apparently it's female bees that do the work. And that bee has chosen to go to that particular flower, breaks in, grabs the nectar, runs off, gets away with the goods. But we know that this sense of control the bee feels, assuming he feels it, she feels it, is simply a failure of bee imagination. That what's really happening is that that plant has cleverly manipulated that bee into paying it a visit. In the case of the bee, this is done. The plant does this by evolving precisely the right combination and kinds of molecules, the right color, the right shape, the right attitude toward the sun, to gratify the bee's desires. We know this from you know, elementary ecology or botany. This is coevolution. Two species coming together to advance their own self-interest, who wind up trading favors, often without knowing it. So how are matters any different between me and the potatoes I was planting, or me and the marijuana plant I wasn't planting in my garden? The plants, too, in those cases, have evolved to gratify our desires. They have, that potato has developed precisely the flavors, the shapes, the colors, to earn a spot in our garden. In this case, I was seduced in the pages of a seed catalog, and I ordered these potatoes from a firm in Oregon, and the genes were flown across the country, or shipped across the country, and that potato seized a little bit of habitat, a couple rows in my garden. Plants, too, evolved to gratify our desires. A certain select group of angiosperms, the domesticated plants, in exchange for which we help them to reproduce, we give it more habitat, and we carry its genes all around the world. This is what I mean by the botany of desire. Our desires, and the desire we're going to talk about tonight is specifically the desire for intoxication, for changes in consciousness, are a powerful force in evolution, in natural history, in evolution. Just the way the hummingbird's desire and love of red is. Now, offer first of two disclaimers. This process is not intentional. When I talk about these plants cleverly manipulating us, I'm obviously using figurative language. We don't have a very good vocabulary for talking about how other species act on us, about their agency. We see the world as we're the subject, we're the thinking subject, and then you've got the inert object. And so, you know, I pull the weeds, I plant the potatoes, I harvest the crops. But this is just a limitation of our language. You know, even real evolutionary biologists talk about things like evolutionary strategy, and the word strategy has intent, forethought in it. But of course, we know that's not how it works. The first red apple was not the result of a bunch of green apples sitting around a table saying, "Let's try red today. We'll do a red apple. We'll see if we get noticed, and we'll see if we get, you know, pulled." It was a mutation. It was strictly an accident. So, even though I'm going to use this kind of language, I don't think plants are conscious. I'm not the Oliver Stone of the plant world. There's no conspiracy here. Now, why do plants need to go to all this trouble? The THC molecule, one of the active ingredients of marijuana, is a very novel, complicated molecule, and it takes some expense, metabolic expense, for the plant to produce it. These colors, these scents, all these are expensive propositions. Well, the main reason plants need to do all this to gratify our desires is they can't move. The single great existential fact of plant life is, well, they can't locomote. They can move with the wind and water, but they can't pick themselves up and go. So what they've worked on, what they have, are chemicals instead of legs. Cannabis works on our minds in order to borrow our feet, basically. And plants have developed this incredible variety of molecules, and again, we're only going to concentrate on one or two today, either to attract or repel other species. They have to rely on chemistry for their defense and for their propagation, for their movement. So even though I won't, and they've gotten really, really good at this, you know, they're so unlike us, we really fail to appreciate their genius. And although I won't speak in terms of plant consciousness, I will speak in terms of genius. And I think you can make a case that they are as advanced as we are. You look a little skeptical. But when you think about it, what does that mean to be an advanced creature, an advanced being? It all depends on what advances you value and who's drawing up the yardstick. You know, we value consciousness and tool making and the ability to write books and give lectures. But by the yardstick of organic chemistry, they are so far beyond us. They've been evolving even longer than we have, just in another direction, working on other ways to confront the same challenges of life on Earth, especially the challenges of reproduction and defense. Now, you still look skeptical. Another measure we could look at, trying to be objective about this, just has recently come out, and that is the size of the human genome. I don't know if you followed this, but I think the most interesting thing to come out of the much ballyhooed mapping of the genome was the number of genes we apparently have. The first estimate is, and this came as something of a surprise, only about 35,000. Now, this is actually kind of scandalous if you consider that the roundworm, a creature that can't do all sorts of things, has something like 20,000 genes. How is it that we ended up with so many fewer genes than were predicted? They predicted over 100,000, I believe. Another species we've mapped at the same time is rice. You know how many genes rice has, first count? 50,000. 15,000 more genes than we have. Why should this be? Now, I don't know that's a fair standard for being more advanced, but it is one snapshot on complexity. And the reason probably has to do with the fact that everything rice does depends on producing interesting molecules, proteins, and you need genes to do that. So perhaps that's why. So anyway, I have enormous respect for the sophistication of these plants. We shouldn't sell them short. While we were nailing down consciousness and locomotion, they were perfecting organic chemistry, and they've gotten, you know, the arts of molecular seduction and defense. They are nature's alchemists, indeed. There are lots of examples. I'll just give you one. Well, photosynthesis is, of course, one of the great examples. I mean, this is an astonishing trick to be able to take sunlight and water and very common elements and create sugars, food energy. We can do nothing like this. But the other example I've come across recently is the lima bean, and I kind of like this one as a gardener. You know what a lima bean does when it's attacked by spider mites? It releases a volatile chemical from its leaves that goes off in the air and summons another insect that dines exclusively on spider mites. So it sends out this chemical SOS, and these insects come to its rescue and eat all the spider mites, and everybody's happy. You know, our idea of a pesticide by comparison is just so crude, it's not funny. When people ask about, you know, do you think your plants are conscious and all, I mean, isn't it enough that they can eat sunlight and do these things? So anyway, I'm a believer in plant genius. Now let's get to the case of drug plants. One of the most important relationships we have with plants involves changing consciousness. Now when I talk about changing consciousness, I'm not just talking about illicit drugs. I'm talking about things like coffee and nicotine and tea and also anything that changes the texture of consciousness. We're not talking about hallucinogens, although we'll talk a little bit about them. Apparently all cultures except the Inuit have used plants to change consciousness. And the Inuit are truly the exception that proves the rule. The reason they didn't is that nothing very psychoactive grows where they live. As soon as plants with these powers were introduced, they took to them pretty quickly. So they are truly the exception that proves the rule. This desire for changing consciousness, Andrew Weil calls it the fourth human drive after food, water, and sex. And I think he's right. And it's a very widespread activity. It's a lot more widespread than we realize, and it doesn't always involve drugs. The way he describes it his first book, The Natural Mind, is still well worth reading. But he points out that kids love to change consciousness, and they do it swinging. They do it by getting dizzy. We do it with exercise and meditation and fasting and thrill-seeking. We're creatures, apparently, who just happen to like to fiddle with our brain chemistry. Most cultures, curiously, promote one plant for this purpose, or two, and condemn others. They fetishize one and they have taboos on others. And if you look at things historically or geographically, cross-culturally, you'll see that it's very relative and subject to change. In my garden, I have these apple trees that were planted in the teens. Back in the 20s, those apple trees during Prohibition were regarded the way, say, a drug czar would regard a marijuana plant today. They were evil. They were a root of all evil, producing alcohol, and they were chopped down in many places by Carrie Nation. That's what her hatchet symbolized. It was something to chop down apple trees because they were used for cider. At the same time, you could go into any pharmacy in America and buy preparations containing cannabis, tinctures of cannabis, as well as tinctures of opium. So you have these, and of course, you know, between the Muslim world and the West, you have a flip between opiates and alcohol. So, you know, it's always going back and forth. This plant is a panacea, and this one is a panopathogen, or root of all evil. So this is just seems to be a constant in human societies. Now, what's the use of these drug plants in evolutionary terms? Well, one of the more interesting theories was proposed by Steven Pinker, the brain scientist, and he thinks our attraction to plant drugs is the coming together of two distinct adaptive traits. We have the system of brain rewards, such that anytime we do something very heroic or useful, our brain is flooded with chemicals that make us feel good. That's very adaptive. We also have this big brain designed for solving problems. So you bring the second trait to bear on the first, and you've figured out a way to trick the brain into triggering its reward system. It's a pretty good theory. We're not the only species who do this, though. You know, animals also get high, like to be intoxicated. Everyone's familiar with the example of catnip and loco weed. And in fact, it appears that animals were our Virgils in the garden of psychoactive plants. We learned about a lot of them from watching animals get high. Coffee was discovered, apparently, by Abyssinian goat herders watching their goats. What their goats would do is eat the red berries off this one particular bush and get really frisky. And their herders realized, well, we're going to try this too. And somewhere along the line, they learned to roast the beans, and we had coffee. So you do have this as going through many parts of the animal world, too. Now, it would seem to be maladaptive, though, to use these drugs, these plant drugs. It does make creatures more mistake-prone. Animals that get high blow child care. They make lots of mistakes. They have accidents. They ruin their health. There's a herbivore that will eat a psychoactive lichen off of rocks until they've completely destroyed their teeth and can no longer eat and die. Yet they also do have utility. If you think about it, on our evolutionary journey, something that gave you such pain relief, mental acuity in the case of things like coffee, something that helped smooth the waters of social relations, helped to work and to hunt. Many cultures use drugs in a very specific way right before the hunt to give them powers of endurance and things like that. So they can be also powerful mental tools on life's journey. They also can relieve existential pain and boredom. There's this very depressing quote from Huxley, who said in his book about drugs, Doors of Perception, "Most men and women lead lives at the worst so painful, at the best so monotonous, poor, and limited that the urge to escape, the longing to transcend themselves, if only for a few moments, is and has always been one of the principal appetites of the soul." It's kind of dark. So I think, like a lot of things in life, the answer to the question, are plant drugs, are psychoactive drugs good or evil, is both. They're a blessing and a scourge. And the Greeks pretty much had it right. You know, they had one word, pharmakon, that meant both medicine and poison. Now, to pot, to marijuana, to this particular co-evolutionary relationship. Why did this plant make THC in the first place? THC being the main psychoactive ingredient. It certainly wasn't so people could get high. It did not produce this to make us, to change our consciousness. It probably produced this chemical first for its own purposes. And these are still unknown. There's some theories. One is that THC helps protect the plant against insects. Another is that it helps protect against ultraviolet radiation. You find more THC as you go up higher in elevation, and you have more UV rays. Another is that it's an aid to help the plant defend itself against predators. And if that's true, it's kind of a brilliant defense. When you're playing around with the arms race between plants and their predators, outright poison is sometimes not the best way to go. When you put out a powerful poison, you select for resistance, and very soon you've developed it, as we find with pesticides all the time. But think how much more clever it would be to have a defense against predators that makes them forget where they saw you last time. Now, I have some firsthand experience with this. Well, secondhand, actually, not exactly firsthand. My cat is—I grow catnip for my cat. He definitely has a problem with it. And during the garden season, every evening when I'm harvesting something for dinner, he comes down to the vegetable garden and he waits to be let in. I open the gate and he goes in, and he wants to go find his catnip. And every night, I have to show him where it is again. Granted, he's not the brightest cat, but it's like, it's that one. So catnip is a very different thing than THC, but you can see the usefulness of a chemical that would cause your predator to forget where you are. So that's my theory. I hasten to add, this isn't, I don't think there's any science behind that. Marijuana was discovered, it appears, in Central Asia. Perhaps thanks to birds. Pigeons love the seeds of marijuana and get a little tipsy on them. And it may be a case where that tipped people off to what it was. It was probably purely accidental that this plant, this chemical, happened to be active in human brains. But that's no different than any other one of the accidents of which evolution and coevolution is built upon. Plants seized on this accident and throve. Marijuana became one of the earliest plants to be domesticated, first as a fiber, though, by the Chinese, hemp. It's been so changed by its 15,000 years of coevolution with us that apparently marijuana in its wild form doesn't exist anymore. We don't really know what the plant in the wild was like, how psychoactive it was, how good a fiber it was. And the plant comes down on there are sort of two lines of evolutionary or coevolutionary descent, which is very interesting. You start with the same plant, but you come down and you're developing one plant for the fiber, because marijuana has the longest, strongest fiber. We're not going to talk about hemp very much, and that's how the Chinese started with it. It was, in fact, the most important fiber for both paper and cloth up until the invention of the cotton gin, only in the 19th century. And on that path of descent, it moved west from China to northern Europe and on to America. The other path of descent was as a medicine, and people selected for stronger and stronger medicine. It was used for pain relief, help with childbirth, as an anti-inflammatory, anti-spasmodic, anti-anxiety, and a treatment for insomnia. And on the second path, it moves from Central Asia down into India to Africa. And from Africa, it appears to come to the New World, to South America first, with the slave trade. And then it comes up from Egypt to Europe with Napoleon's army returning to France. So it came kind of late to Europe. Along the way, we changed the plant, selecting for either a better fiber or a stronger drug, and the plant changed us. Individually, by giving us this tool, helping us with pain and that sort of thing, but also collectively, because that's something else that plant drugs do. Besides being mental tools, plant drugs work on us at this higher level, at a cultural level. And now I'm entering a very speculative area, and this is where I hope I can inspire someone to take this further. But you could write, and a few people have tried, a natural history of religion, in which you could find or speculate on the role of plant drugs in a great many religions. It was recently, not so recently, but 20 or 30 years ago, discovered that Soma, the cult of Soma, the Aryan religion, which may be one of the first religions, was a fungus, was a fly agaric mushroom, created those visions. In many traditions, the shamanic tradition in South America, cannabis in Indian religion, cannabis in witchcraft. Cannabis was used as an anti-sacrament in medieval witchcraft. Wine, which was mixed with other things in ancient Greece. Drug plants have and fungi have been a bridge between our world and other worlds. To what extent, we don't really know. But I came across this one quote from a historian of religion writing in 62. So this isn't a 60s. There's a real 60s literature about this that's kind of dubious. But this was written in 62, and she makes this point. Her name is Mary Bernard. Which was more likely to happen first? The spontaneously generated idea of an afterlife in which the disembodied soul, liberated from the restrictions of time and space, experiences eternal bliss, or the accidental discovery of hallucinogenic plants that give a sense of euphoria, dislocate the center of consciousness, and distort time and space, making them balloon outward in greatly expanded vistas. If you put it that way, you know, it's hard to imagine this idea of an alternate universe, of a heaven, of a hell, without drugs. But who knows? I also think you could write, and it would be a very interesting book, A Natural History of the Imagination, and that you could look at the role that plant drugs and fungi have played in certain moments in our cultural history. Philosophy. We know that many of the great thinkers of ancient Greece participated in a annual religious rite at which a hallucinogenic potion was consumed. The Mysteries of Eleusis, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, it was a harvest festival to Demeter. And the thought is, and again this is a theory, that because everybody was sworn to secrecy about what was going on, but that ergo, a fungus that grows on grain, which ties into the Demeter thing, was consumed. It's at the molecular level, it's very closely related to LSD. Now, we don't know what impact, if any, this had on Greek thought, and it seems almost impious to suggest it had any, but what would we think if we discovered, say, a secret manuscript telling us that Plato's metaphysics were the result of his drug trips? For surely one of the effects often reported by people who have used drugs could be called the Platonic effect. And I'm quoting one writer on this. He talked about, under the influence of drugs, a cup begins to look like the Platonic ideal of a cup. A landscape looks like a landscape painting. A Jerry Garcia guitar solo sounds like the music of the spheres. Drugs can make people feel as though they've been admitted to this realm of archetypal forms. So, highly provisional idea. Less provisional, though, is the role of drugs in romanticism, basically because Coleridge spoke of it and attributed to opium his notion of suspension of disbelief and this idea of the secondary imagination, this faculty that starts with the world of fixed and dead ideas, dead objects, which it then, and this is a quote, dissolves, diffuses, dissipates in order to recreate. This is an entirely new mode of imagination. We're moving beyond mimesis to something much more like modern art, and this idea owes to experiments with opium. David Lenson is an interesting literary critic and musician who's written a great book on drugs called On Drugs, and I recommend it. It got very little attention when it came out a couple years ago. But he writes that our operative idea of imagination, dating back to the tail end of the 18th century, is inextricably linked to our history of intoxication. However, criticism has tried to sanitize this process, we have to face the fact that some of our canonical poets and theorists, when apparently talking about imagination, are really talking about getting high. He puts things in kind of dramatic ways. Another area to look at, which Lenson looks at too, is improvisation. This amazing invention of both jazz and rock improvisation. Without THC specifically, I think improvisation is a very hard thing to imagine ever happening. I'm thinking in terms of the break in the linear flow and then the spatialization of time that goes on. And if you look at the history of rock and roll, you find that even a lot of musicians that we think of as acid-influenced, LSD-influenced musicians, when they were performing, they restricted themselves to cannabis. This is true of Jimi Hendrix. And that acid was a whole other part of their lives. But THC was the drug for improvising. And Lenson talks about this now more as a musician. He says, what is shared, and this is the solo, he's talking about the solo, what is shared, the melody, is now his or hers to diffuse, dissolve, dissipate, and recreate. The song's spatial aspect is redrawn. The improvisational expanse must be filled. Pot makes improvisational space virtual, opening dimensions and possibilities so that the apparent infinity is interesting rather than terrifying. Marijuana, the most user-constructed of all drugs, is the great yay-sayer, supporting and encouraging whatever is going on anyway, and introducing very little of its own, or nothing of its own. It helps you understand that there is no predetermined right or wrong thing to do with the enormous space at your disposal. There is only what you do. Now, this very sketchy idea of a natural history of the imagination, I come to my second disclaimer. I don't want to sound like I'm offering a brief for drug use. I see drugs acting on human culture as mutagens, in the same way that we understand that ultraviolet radiation creates mutations in the genetic copying, which are mistakes, 99% of which are disastrous for the creature. Yet mistakes are a very important part of cultural evolution. Think of Harold Bloom's idea of the creatively productive misreading. If nothing else, drugs lead to plenty of misreadings, and most of them stupid, but every now and then one comes along that changes everything. And that's really what I'm talking about here, that drugs do this for us. Now, I want to get a little bit more to the harder science for a second. One of the horriest cliches of the 60s was that drugs like cannabis and others would unlock secrets of consciousness. Well, it turns out that Timothy Leary, Allen Ginsberg, and some of the others were sort of right. THC, in particular, has thrown open a door onto the workings of the mind that they never would have imagined. And we have learned things about neuroscience by studying cannabis. So the answer to understanding consciousness through drugs, though, was from studying it, not from smoking it. It begins in the 60s, trying to figure out how this plant works, marijuana. And a very important, I think, Israeli neuroscientist named Raphael Meshulam, in the 1960s, isolates THC, delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol. Then a couple years later, 1988, a researcher at St. Louis University named Alan Howlett discovers receptors in the brain and elsewhere, in some very interesting places, that THC activates. And one of those places includes the uterus, which, in view of the history of the drug in helping with childbirth, makes a certain sense. Now, she hypothesized and others that we did not have these receptors to respond to THC, so that the brain must produce another chemical, an endogenous cannabinoid, that these receptors were designed to interlock with. And then four years later, in 1992, Meshulam again, his lab, discovers what this endogenous cannabinoid is. And he names it anandamide, which is the Sanskrit word for inner bliss. You know this is a man working in Israel and not in the U.S. under a grant from the National Institute of Drug Abuse. I don't think that name would have washed here. Later, another cannabinoid called, less poetically, 2-AG was also discovered. And the question arises, what do we have the system for? And this is where it gets really interesting. Anandamide works very much like THC, but it's a neurotransmitter, so that it needs to be shorter acting. You don't want your neurotransmitters hanging around in the brain for too long, or you'll just get clogged up with stuff. So they break down very quickly. You have reuptake of your serotonin and things like that. But it does everything THC seems to do. Affects your short-term memory, pain, focus, emotion, and appetite. One way you can prolong the effect of anandamide once it's been released in your brain, interestingly enough, is with chocolate. You know, people often talk about the effects of chocolate on mood. What it may do, not so much that it's a drug itself, but it seems to prolong the effect of other drugs in the brain, anandamide specifically. And that may be why it makes you feel good. I want to focus on memory, but this exploration of anandamide and 2-AG has opened up some other interesting things. And one, of course, is appetite. The neuroscience of the munchies has basically been discovered. And this just happened. They were able to breed knockout mice that don't have these receptors, and they found something very interesting. These knockout mice do not nurse. They do not have the desire to suck at their mother's breasts, and they eventually die. But if you then administer THC to them, their appetite is restored and they thrive. So it appears that anandamide acts in a kind of seesaw relation with another chemical called leptin, and that is the brain's signal for satiety, that you're full. And many of these chemicals work, it's hypothesized, in a kind of seesaw relationship with one another. So you have anandamide on one side and leptin on the other. This opens up enormous possibilities for control of appetite. So I think that's a very significant finding. There's also been a lot of work done on another constituent of marijuana. I'm not going to go into it, but cannabidiol, which is not psychoactive by itself. And there's a lot of great research showing that it's a great anti-inflammatory. It's a neuroprotectant, and it may be what gives medical marijuana patients relief on things like epilepsy and anxiety. The cannabidiol can be separated now from the THC. You can actually produce a non-psychoactive kind, but there's a lot of patent issues. Nobody wants to patent a plant drug. I mean, nobody wants to develop a plant drug because you can't patent it. So nothing's happening with this. There is a company, though, in England, GW Pharmaceuticals, that's in stage 3 trials with a cannabidiol aerosol that you put under your tongue that they're hoping to sell as a help for MS patients. But back to this neural network and anandamide. I asked both Howlett and Mashulam, why do we have this cannabinoid system in the first place? Remember, it works just like THC. It's involved with pain release, loss of short-term memory, sedation, mild cognitive impairment. Howlett said, all those things that you've just said are exactly what Adam and Eve would want after being thrown out of Eden. You couldn't design a more perfect drug, this is her quote to me, for getting Eve through the pain of childbirth and helping Adam endure a life of physical toil. She's basically saying this is the brain's own drug for coping with the human condition. Mashulam had an even more interesting take on it. He thinks anandamide will be found to be crucially involved in emotion, how we take, he described it, the experience of seeing my grandchildren come into a room and feeling good, and that translation. He thinks it's involved in that, although that hasn't been nailed down. But it certainly is involved with memory. And I asked him this question, which, why would we evolve a chemical that would make us forget short-term memory? This seems maladaptive. And I wrote him this in an email, and he wrote me an email back that was one of the great aha moments when I was working on this book. And he said, well, do you really want to remember all the faces you saw on the subway this morning? All the faces in the supermarket? And I realized at that moment, well, of course. Forgetting is not a defect of a mental operation, although it can certainly be that. Forgetting is a mental operation, and it's almost as important as remembering. He believes that there is another seesaw there. There is a chemical that helps us lock in memories, and anandamide works on the other side to make us get rid of memories, short-term and long-term. Now, he offered this as speculation, and the proof is starting to come in. There was a fascinating article in Nature this summer by Marzicano and a group of other researchers. And they found that, I'm going to talk first about long-term memory, then we'll talk about short-term memory. Cannabinoids, they said, are essential in the extinction of conditioned fear and traumatic memory. We need cannabinoids to forget horrible things that happen. And the way they did this was they had mice that every time they heard a certain tone, they got an electric shock. So they conditioned them to be fearful when they heard this tone. Normal mice, you play the tone, and the first time they react fearfully, but you play it enough times and they forget and they just go about their business. And this is what happens. But these knockout mice that cannot use the anandamide their brains are producing never forget the fear. It is never extinguished. Which I think is very interesting, that if you didn't have anandamide, you might not ever be able to get over things like post-traumatic stress, and it indeed may be useful in treating that. Phobias of various kind, neuroses of various kind, even chronic pain. You know, it's often been observed that pain is the hardest of all experiences to summon from memory. You know something felt really bad, but it's very hard to recreate that emotion the way you can recreate other emotions. And it may be that we have the cannabinoids to thank for that. Now, as I've looked at the literature of forgetting, I found that there's very, very little of it. There's a lot more on memory, which kind of makes sense, I guess. Memory is crucial to identity, to culture, but forgetting is really crucial too. For our psychological health, I would argue, for certain spiritual experiences, and even for learning. Memory is important for learning, but so is forgetting. One great thinker who has written a little bit on forgetting is William James. He kind of figured out this point about forgetting. And I'll read you a quote from him. And I don't even know where it's from, but Boorstin in The Discoverers has this quote. "In the practical use of our intellect, forgetting is as important a function as remembering. If we remembered everything, we should on most occasions be as ill off as if we remembered nothing. It would take as long for us to recall a space of time as it took the original time to elapse." That's a kind of spacey idea. "And we should never get ahead with our thinking. All recollected times undergo foreshortening. And this foreshortening is due to the omission of an enormous number of facts which filled them. We thus reach the paradoxical result," he is such a boring writer, isn't he? "That one condition of remembering is that we should forget. Without totally forgetting a prodigious number of states of consciousness and momentarily forgetting a large number, we could not remember at all." It's a very sweet idea. Now, we actually do have one great case study of a man who remembered everything. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this book by the great Russian psychologist A.R. Luria, The Mind of the Mnemonist. Luria is a very interesting writer. He's sort of the model, I think, Oliver Sacks's model. And he wrote a book about a Russian Jew he treated in the 30s he calls S. "Any sequence of words or numbers or abstract symbols you presented to this man, he could remember and recall. The limit of his memory was never reached in any test he took. He could bring it all back indefinitely. He saw the figures as images. Everything presented itself as sheets of paper. And he could see all the numbers you gave him or equations, or so he could recite them forward or backwards or any way you wanted. He visualized it all, sort of like a memory palace idea. And he became a mnemonist. He became a professional memory performer, and he went and did 3 shows a day where people would put forth, you know, these outrageously long lists of words and things, and he would remember them all. But as time went on, he became tormented by his inability to forget, either long or short term. Luria says that traces left by one stimulus did not inhibit those of another. They showed no signs of becoming extinguished with time, nor did they become any less selective with the years. And images of these numbers and words he was doing in these performances would just come unbidden to his mind, and they began to drive him crazy. And he would have these mental exercises. He did visualize everything. He would actually crumple up these pages in his mind and burn them, throw them in the fire. And then he would look in the fire, and he would see the crumpled paper, and he could actually make out, he could still make out the words and images and numbers, and he was just this torment. The short-term memory was a problem too. When you read him a story, every word summoned another image. So that if you, and Luria talks about reading him a story, and it has a line like, the man leaned on a tree, and Ash gets this image of a forest, and then the next line is, and then he looked into his shop window, and oh my God, it wasn't in the woods, we're in the city, and then the city image came in, and S is quoted as saying, no, this is too much, each word calls up images, they collide with one another, and the result is chaos, I can't make anything out of this. I mean, just imagine if you couldn't lose the images that were coming into your mind. It suggests that, and he couldn't get the gist of a story or an argument because he couldn't forget what wasn't important. All that suggests that abstracting or distilling depends on forgetting, depends on editing. S had to learn tricks for forgetting the way we have to learn tricks for memory. And he eventually learned some. He would close a white curtain over something and it would disappear, and that seemed to work. Perhaps he was like those knockout mice. I don't know. Friedrich Nietzsche is the other writer who's written about forgetting. And he wrote, if you haven't read this, you really should treat yourself. But in 1876, he wrote an essay called The Uses and Disadvantages of History for Life, which is just a pin to the virtues of forgetting. It starts like this. Consider the cattle grazing as they pass you by. They do not know what is meant by yesterday or today. They leap about, eat, rest, digest, leap about again, and so from morn till night and from day to day, fettered to the moment and its pleasure or displeasure, and thus neither melancholy or bored. No nemesis here. A human being may well ask an animal, why do you not speak to me of your happiness, but only stand and gaze at me? The animal would like to answer and say, the reason is, I always forget what I was going to say. But then he forgot that answer too and stayed silent. It's a great essay, and he's talking about how cheerfulness, the good conscience, the joyful deed, doing anything really depends on forgetting. He's very much like Emerson and Thoreau in this. And he believes you can't have a great passion without forgetting, or a conviction. And he says, those who can act are those who, quote, forget most things so as to do one thing. To do, or I would add, to think or to feel, and certainly to write. I know writing for me involves prodigious amounts of forgetting. All this I'm very attracted to because I have a terrible memory. So this all is a consolation to me. But Emerson and Thoreau, too, had this idea of laboring under the weight of convention in the past, and nature became their technology to help them forget, to push things out of the way. Now, short-term memory, forgetting is crucial here, too, as Nietzsche suggests. To paraphrase, you know, the ability to forget most things in order to attend to one, well, that's the key to what I hope is going on still in this room right now. Your ability to attend to my words, think about it, depends on forgetting 99% of the sense information coming in right now. Think about all you're not thinking about right now, just for a second. The discomfort of your chair for sitting this long, the whir of the ventilation system, the lights, the architectural detailings, the screen, your dinner plans, your homework, the taste in your mouth, the smells, how all this talk of intoxication maybe makes you want to have a drink or maybe something stronger. I mean, forgetting is not just about the past. It's an important thing to remember. To be here now depends on forgetting a great deal of sensory information in the near present, and even forgetting the future too. Worries, anticipations, intentions, all these things can be forgotten also. So what I'm suggesting is that anandamide is crucial to this operation, to editing out all of the near-term memories so that you can forget the extraneous, and attend. Andrew Wild, as I mentioned earlier, talks about a lot of this in Natural Mind. He says, disturbance of immediate memory seems to be a common feature of all altered states of consciousness in which attention is focused on the present. So I think this goes beyond the altered states of consciousness. We're talking about cannabis. But sport gives it to us also. And thrill-seeking, and any of the different technologies we have for immersing ourselves in the present. You cannot toe that line, as Thoreau said, without ridding yourself of the past and the future. this notion of presentness, really, and it's the goal of meditation, and it's the goal of experiences we call transcendence. The seeker, the spiritual seeker, you think about it, works to put aside past and future, the better to toe the line of the present moment. And there are many examples in both Eastern and Western thought where this experience of the present becomes our doorway onto eternity. In the West, Boethius said the spiritual goal is to hold and possess the whole fullness of life in one moment, here and now, past and present and to come. And there's the Zen master who said, awakening to this present instant, we realize the infinite is the finite of each instant. What I'm suggesting is we can't get from here to there without first forgetting. And we will find that it is the cannabinoids that mediate this process. But isn't there something a little artificial about this? How does this make us feel? Is a chemically conditioned spiritual experience any less real? Does it make a difference if the chemical involved is endogenous or artificial? And why? Huxley wrote about this a little bit. He said that all our experiences are chemically conditioned, of course. And if we imagine that some of them are purely spiritual, purely intellectual, or purely aesthetic, it is merely because we have never troubled to investigate the internal chemical environment at the moment of their occurrence. So humans have found many ways to fiddle with their brain chemistry. And that's exactly what's going on. Meditation, fasting, risk. Even the placebo effect, remember, we're not just fooling ourselves into thinking we're happier when we take a placebo antidepressant. We're actually producing more serotonin. So why does using a plant like cannabis still strike us, for spiritual purposes, strike us as false and cheap? Is it the work ethic? No pain, no gain? I think the problem is really the provenance of those chemicals in this case, that they come from outside us. And even worse, that they come from nature, from plants. We have a name for someone who believes spiritual knowledge might come from such a quarter, and that is a pagan. And we have a story about that, and it's called Genesis. For what was the knowledge God wanted to keep from Adam and Eve in the garden? I would argue that the content was not nearly as important as the form, that there was spiritual knowledge to be had from nature, from a plant. The tree in the garden was a seriously psychoactive plant. And the new monotheistic faith had sought to break the human bond with magic nature, to disenchant the world of plants and animals by directing our gaze to a single God in the sky. But this new God can't just pretend the tree of knowledge didn't exist, not when generations of plant-worshipping and consuming pagans knew better. So the tree of knowledge is allowed to grow in the Garden of Eden, but ringed around now with a powerful taboo. Taste it and you will be punished. And interestingly, the punishment involves remembering, involves falling into history and shame. And this, I suggest, is the drug war's first battle. But I want to end on a much more positive and, well, intoxicating note. This is from a passage from the book. Plants with the power to revise our thoughts and perceptions, to provoke metaphor and wonder, challenge our ingrained Judeo-Christian belief that our conscious waking selves somehow stand apart from nature, have achieved a kind of transcendence, or that kind of transcendence. Just what happens to this flattering self-portrait if we discover that transcendence itself owes to molecules that flow through our brains and at the same time through the plants in the garden? If some of the brightest fruit of human culture are in fact rooted deeply in the earth with the plants and fungi, is nature then, as Sartre claimed, mute? Or might it mean that spirit is in fact part of nature? Well, there may be no older idea in the world. In The Birth of Tragedy, Friedrich Nietzsche described Dionysian intoxication as nature overpowering mind, nature having her way with us. The Greeks understood that this was not something to be undertaken lightly or too often. Intoxication for them was a carefully circumscribed ritual, never a way to live, because they understood that Dionysus can make angels of us or animals. It all depends. Even so, letting nature have her way with us now and again still seems like a useful thing to do, if only as a check on our hubris, if only to bring our abstracted upward gaze back down to earth for a time. What a re-enchantment of the world that would be, to look around us and see that the plants and the trees of knowledge grow in the garden still. Thank you very much.